Thank you guys so much. Thank you. Thank you for that fine opening act we had. Thank you so much.
It was horrible, wasn't it?
Believe me, the more you drink, the better I sound. Actually, it was him. But it's a pleasure to be here with our Island Brewing for having us over tonight, and of course of the RCCW, the big show tomorrow afternoon is going to be nice, and they told me it's going to be really warm outside, and I said, how much is that? And they, oh, it's going to be like 80 degrees. I said, are you kidding? I'm freezing my ass off. I live in Phoenix. You guys all know about it. I know you folks do. But I see you out there in Mesa all the time. What are you doing back over here? How many of you folks from Mesa, Arizona, come over here to live here even then you go back to Mesa? No, you're not going to say you're from Mesa. You're going to say, well, we're from Wisconsin. We're from Minnesota. We just use Mesa because we like to come there and we like to plant all our flowers and the grass and everything and bring our, you know, our plant allergies with us out to the desert. See, I'm a desert guy. I've been out there for like 30 years now. My yard has cactus in it and rocks. I don't believe in the grass that you guys want to have. And don't mess with that now. You should have already had it working by now. He had his spot. Nobody messed with him. But I live, he has that radio voice. Where's my radio guy? There he is. He has a radio voice. He talks like the man on the 5 o'clock news. The weather guy.
It's going to not rain tomorrow.
But anyway, I lived in Memphis for most of my life, all my life, and then I went to college there. And someone asked me earlier a question, and when I was in college, a couple of my college friends talked me into starting in pro wrestling, or try to do it. Anyway, I had a cousin that was already in pro wrestling. This is to answer his question.
And Jerry and Homer are really your cousin?
Yes, Jerry and I are cousins. He didn't put it that way. He had a manly voice. That's him. That was his question. But anyway, Jerry's mother and my mother, they both passed away now, were sisters. And he was in the wrestling business. He had gone to Memphis State University where I went. He was on an art scholarship, and I was there doing athletics. And I thought, well, here this guy's drawing photos. I'm the one that's the athlete, and he's doing this pro wrestling. But my friends talked me into going and trying it one Sunday night. And after that, I kept going back and going back and going back. And I trained for almost a year. My training partner was Bert Mantoto Beware. Yes. And I got my degree in health and physical education. I was a school teacher. Well, yes, in the 70s, I had the sideburns. And I did that for a year and a half, 2 years. I starved to death. The three least paying jobs in across America for professional people is you want someone to come and help you when you're in trouble and take the criminals away, the police. You want someone to come and put the fire out in your house so you don't lose all your belongings. That's the fireman. And you want someone to teach your children to grow up, be upstanding, fine citizens. That's your teachers. And none of those three get paid worth of crap. And you guys know that. It's terrible. We have these things, and then, but anyway, that's a different story. So I trained for wrestling, and then I resigned from teaching school, and I started out in the wrestling business in 1976, and I just never looked back. I said I would try it for 5 years, then 5 years went by. My teaching license was for 10 years, so I had like a 10-year plan, really. I got to do something in the next 10 years, or I'm going back to the classroom. So after the 10-year period went by, it's too late then. I'd been out on the road for 10 years, living out of the trunk of my car, making less money than I was making teaching school, thinking that someday it would all be diamond rings and limousines. I believed that when I heard it on television. This guy, Spuckin Monroe, would say that. He was a Cadillac man with diamond rings and limousines. he was a rich girl's lover and a poor girl's dream, and I really thought that was true until I got my one paycheck when I wrestled Luthez one night in a small town in Missouri, and I opened my envelope, and I drove 150 miles there. I wrestled Luthez. I got beat up really bad by him, which I deserved because I was young and dumb and didn't know anything, and I deserved to get beat up, and he beat me up pretty good. And I had $5 for it. And I drove 150 miles back home. And after I bought gasoline for the car, it was 50 cents a gallon then, and a pack of bologna and a pack of cheese, I had no money left. But that was my introduction into the wrestling, and for some reason I continued on with it for over 40 years now. And then, the Hall of Fame. Believe me, I did my speech for the Hall of Fame, and going into that, I just wanted to talk about something other than, like tonight, you guys are getting hour and so of what's happened with me in the course of 40 years. They wanted you to do it in 15 minutes or less. It's hard to put 40 years into 15 minutes. When they asked me to come and induct Coco in the Hall of Fame, obviously they didn't know anything about me or my history with Coco. They said, we'd like for you, if you wouldn't mind, to come and induct Coco Lee Ware in the Hall of Fame. And do you know him or know anything about him? I said, well, I've known him for like 35 years, and we started together. I said, yeah, I'd love to come and do it. They said, can you talk about him for 3 minutes and no more? I said, sure. So for 3 minutes, I gave them my real quick story about Coco and how we started together. But they wanted me to do this all in 15 minutes. And I put together a speech. I worked on it for about, because they have to look at everything.
Yep, everything.
Don't let me forget, I'll have a Nick Bachman story for you in a few minutes. Don't let me forget. It's a good little story. Yeah. But anyway, I've made this speech up about how I developed this character. Because the character was something that I created, and I wanted the world to know, and especially I wanted the WWE office and everyone to know this was my creation. You know, it's like when you discover a good recipe and everyone comes over and they love it and they like it and you're proud because it was your creation, or you drew something, or you built something in your backyard, or you did something somewhere that you're proud of. And I know that WWE likes to take credit for everything. They are worse than Donald Trump. I think that Vince and Donald Trump could be like twins. You're fired. Vince was the first guy to do that. It wasn't Donald. But anyway, I talked about how I developed this character and over the years what I did with it and how that it came about and everything. And that's why some of the guys go out and do these Hall of Fame speeches and they talk about what they did 30, 40 years ago. It doesn't mean anything to you folks as fans that you've been fans of a product called WWE, or you were fans of a product of AWA Wrestling, or you were fans of Dick the Bruiser or out of Chicago or something. For me to talk about what I did in Memphis or what I did in Tupelo, Mississippi, or what I did in San Antonio, Texas, or a year I lived in Puerto Rico, that doesn't mean anything to today's fans. Today's fans want to know about all the dirt behind the scenes of WWE. And I just felt for that 15 minutes I needed to tell this story that I didn't even think my wife and my two children really knew how I developed and came up with this silly nonsense black hair and sideburns. Believe me, it had nothing to do with Elvis. Nothing at all. Elvis not even where it was, or even if I started with it. It was like, that wasn't even it. But it kind of that persona then started to grow on me, and other people would start adding it to it that said, oh, you'd look good if you had a jumpsuit. And by the way, next thing you know, some fans made me a jumpsuit. Then the promoter said, it'd be great if you know how to play guitar. I said, no, I don't know anything about it. He said, that makes it even better, man. The worse you are, the better. So he brings a guitar. I mean, I didn't create the character for any of that. That part was given to me. The jumpsuits, I wish I had never, ever started that shit. Now I know why you women stopped wearing them. When you go to the bathroom, you got to take everything off. Man. And now you go out in the countryside, I have for the last 30 years, and all the promoters, will you wear the jumpsuit? No. You go to a Comic Con or you do a convention somewhere for 10 hours, you're sitting in a booth and they want you to sit there with a jumpsuit on. Well, would you make Hulk Hogan come and wear his yellow speedos? Would you have Roddy Piper sit there and blow the bagpipes for 10 hours during the day? Of course not. But, oh, would you keep your suit on? Well, so what? So finally, I heard about these guys now. You've heard about this guy, Sting, right? I love him to death. He does an autograph signing. Are you guys going to book him? I'll give you a little inside information. If he puts some paint on his face, it's an extra $5,000. I'm okay. Don't believe me. Call him up and book him and see what you get. So I said, well, if he's going to charge $5,000 for painting his face, I'm going to charge $300 to put that suit on. So when I tell the promoter it's $300 extra for me to put the suit on, he goes, oh, forget the suit, forget about it. But I mentioned my son and my daughter and my wife. I went up to Calgary, Canada. I met my wife there. And I ended up in Calgary with her, and then we moved to Pensacola and then back to Calgary, and then my son came along. Then I was on the road for, I don't know, 75, 80, 90 days straight in the road without a day off. And he was born, and I just was there when he was born, and I was gone, and I came back 3 months later. You know, he was already crawling around and almost walking, and I stayed there 2 days, and I was gone 90 more days. Then he was walking, and I don't know if they appreciate what I did. I missed softball and t-ball, and I missed all that. And sometimes I regret it, but I grew up on a cotton farm, sharecroppers. No, we did not own a plantation. We were called sharecroppers. We shared the crop with other families. With my grandfather who owned the place until he passed away, and with other people that lived there, we were sharecroppers, and we did all the farm work. And I just knew that someday, when I did see those neon bright lights of Memphis, I knew I was never going back to that farm. When I left town, I looked at it in the rearview mirror. And in fact, I've not been back. The farm's gone now. It's been finally sold. My dad's gone. Everybody's gone. I never even went back to see it after. I was 25 years, I didn't see that place. I didn't want to see it anymore. Those are childhood memories I didn't want. But I wanted a better life for my wife and my children than what I had. And that's all those parents and leaders expect to do, is give our children a little bit better quality of life than what we had. My daughter will graduate from Texas A&M December the 15th with her Doctor of Veterinary Medicine. 2 days ago, she got hired. She went for a job interview in San Antonio. She starts her new job as a Doctor of Veterinary Medicine in January as an associate vet at a clinic in San Antonio. So all of our work has paid off for her. Yes. She said, Dad, she'll pay me back for that tuition money. You think she's going to pay me back? It wasn't that much. It's only like $85,000 a year. So we're driving along last night. I said, "You guys have pets?" And she said, "How many cats?" "Three cats and one dog." I went, "Ching, ching." Then when she said, "Oh yeah, well, it was three cats," I went, "Ching, ching." She said, "Yeah, no, I have one dog." I went, "Ching, ching, ching, ching." You know, it's like going to the casino and you pull a hat and ching, ching. I wouldn't trade what I did in the rest of the business for anything. It's been something that's been very enjoyable and very annoying. It's been physically hurtful, physically demanding, but yet it's been enjoyable. I guess I love the aggravation. And this young fellow over here was telling me that he tried the wrestling business for a while, and what did you say happened? You got tossed over the top, tore your shoulder and your knee out. Well, if I go home and I complain, you know what they tell me? My daughter says, "Dad, it's the life you chose." My wife says, if I say it was terrible, it was awful, it was terrible booking. You booked it. I do all my own booking. So. I mean, who am I going to complain to? Oh, I don't regret any of it. Well, there's been some things. But I enjoyed doing it so much that I continue to do it. And I wrestled 2 weeks ago in San Diego. I did 3 shows in 1 day at the fair in San Diego. And tomorrow I'll be wrestling again. I don't do a lot of in-ring stuff anymore. And I was telling one of the fellows earlier, I love doing it. Don't get me wrong. It's not that I'm lazy. It's not that I just want to show up and like some of these other guys that I know. I really want to get in there and perform, and I want to do this. And this is what I love doing. I love performing. Believe me, when I was in school, the first time I ever stood in front of a classroom to talk was when I was in college. I had to take a public speaking class just so I could be a teacher. Teachers have to take like one public speaking class so that, you know, you're able to talk. And I had never raised my hand in class or anything. I was not like the class clown or nothing like that. And I was a very introverted, quiet, shy, humble country boy. Look what the hell happened to me. No, these are not my pajamas. These come from a place in Minnesota that made these pants called Subox. They're back in business now. The website's going. And one of the sports stores up in Minneapolis, a big mall up there, they had, and I saw these, and they said, "Yeah, they're back." And I carried a pair home. My son said, "Dad, I haven't seen those in the Where'd you get those 20 years?" And now I wear them, and people look at me like, "He's got on pajamas. They're the most comfortable in your life." But getting back to the enjoyable part of the wrestling, I used to do a lot of military base shows. I went all over the United States, and I did base shows everywhere. And I did base shows all overseas and all over Europe. And every now and again, someone will come up to me, and they'll say, "I was stationed in Camp Casey in South Korea, and you were there." I said, 25, 28 years ago. Yeah, I'm retired now, and this and that, and so you run across people in your life that you've seen, or you might have touched their life somehow, just from our performance. And that's exhilarating for me. That's what I love doing. As far as me telling you about getting back in the ring, or some of these young kids, and I mentioned it earlier, some of these young kids are 300, 400 pound kids. They're like big old farm boys from Nebraska. I don't want them falling on me. I just want to ease myself right on back to my car and go back to my room and have my dinner and go back to Phoenix. And yeah, I don't want to be rolled out in a wheelchair. So I don't like for these kids to touch me anymore. If you will notice, tomorrow they're not going to touch me very much. I became a very good cheerleader. That's a big boy. Go get them. That's it. Go get them. I
right.
You can cheer them on really good now from the outside. The difference is nowadays, and some of you younger people, you see the wrestling, you see our industry totally different from what I was used to seeing. Like I said, I got the crap beat out of me by Luthez. Well, that was his generation. They beat up each other. For real. They all hurt each other. Like, it was a test of their whatever to just laugh about it later on. And yeah. Oh, yeah, you really put one on me tonight, but tomorrow it's payback, brother. You know, they all had noses bent this way, and their ears were all buttered up, and they all talked like Dick the Bruiser, and it was like, man, what have I gotten myself into? I'm a young college boy. But our generation was the Hulk Hogan and the Jake the Snake Roberts and the Paul Orndorff and the Roddy Pipers. And we were more into the larger-than-life entertainment phase as opposed to the Vern Gagne's. The Baron from Ron Rescue will be there tomorrow. Baron was a great college wrestler. And he was one of those, get him down on the mat and grind him out. He's got the big boogered-up ears and everything. But that was just how they did it. And I didn't like it. I'd rather do this. So that was my generation, but this new generation, these kids would go crazy. You're fired. Get out of here. But this new generation, they're goofy. These kids are crazy. They do 100 flips out there and they expect someone to catch them. You listen to them in the locker room and they're going over all this stuff and it's like, what? You're going to knock over equipment. I told someone I was a beer holic. I always carried my 12 back in the locker room. Now here these kids are running around in the locker room. The locker room might only be the size of this stage. And they're picking each other up. And it's like, if you knock my beer over, you little asshole. And did you see that? Her or Corona? I can't even say the name of these moves. I call it a six-pack of Corona. If you can't say it, don't do it. They want to go and flip, and you can't stand. Why don't I just go, sorry, splat. You want me, a 65-year-old, man, I'm glad about my age by 2 years, 67. You want me to catch you while you're diving and flipping? Not tonight. But that's what they do. And they have a career that has not lasted over 40 years like mine. They have a career that lasts maybe 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. And they're so happy. Oh, I got to do it for 1 year. I was on Raw. They're not fans of pro wrestling anymore. They are fans of a thing called Raw. They're fans of a TV show. There used to be a great football game, and it was called the Super Bowl. Now it's a great TV show that features a thing called football. Raw used to be a wrestling. We were on a wrestling show. Now it's a television show that just happens to have wrestling. It's not the same anymore. And I'm not knocking the business because it's better now than it ever has been. But it's not what I like to do. Look, I see these kids riding bicycles down the street up on the handlebars. I didn't learn to ride one that way, and I'm not going to try it. Okay? That's not my cup of tea. That's for you guys. And I see these kids with their pants hanging down on their ass like this. And trying to run from the police, too, and hold your pants up. If you're going to run from the cops, at least put your belt on. We got a policeman over there. Is that true or not? I mean, you're going to run. Why would you be running trying to hold your pants up? For Christ's sakes, man. Okay. Anybody have a question real quick for me? Yes. Yes, sir, in the back. We still have a love-hate relationship. Sometimes he loves me. Sometimes I love him. Sometimes he hates me. Sometimes I hate him. But I think now that I'm in the Hall of Fame, I've been able to now close this chapter of my life that no one ever thought was going to happen for me, not even me. And when this thing came along, I felt like it was the right time. I didn't get to spend any time with Vince that night at all. I would like to get at least 5 minutes to say a few things and, you know, get some water that might still be lingering around under the bridge, get that all washed away and clean the slate and go on our merry way. We weren't able to do that, but I'm just glad to be back as part of the company now, doing some things for them, whatever, and at least they keep me alive on the network. The network has been important for guys like me because the network has given young fans, the younger children, the younger generation, a chance to see what we, our generation, did and how we did. And when I go out and do signings and Comic-Cons and wrestling shows like tomorrow, there'll be kids there that don't know me, whereas 10 years ago, when I would go and do some of these things, the only kids that knew me were kids that were in their 20s who remembered me from back then. And that's really, really heavy. As far as working for Vince, look, I always know the difference between management and labor. Okay? I mean, it's just something you have to understand. If you don't like it, pack your bag. If you're not happy, go somewhere else. If you think you can make the company better, go buy your own company. It's his. I mean, he runs it the way he wants. I'm sorry, Donald Trump's running the country the way he wants to. When he's gone, someone else will do it. But you have to live with what you have. I always tell my daughter, my son, no matter what, no matter what the job is, you have to perform with the tools it's given you. You have to use the tools that's there. And because otherwise, you'll beat yourself to death over it, worrying about it or being mad about it or any of those things. Oh, yes, I quit WWE like 5 times. And they fired me like 5 times. The beauty of the entertainment, the sports business is, it is a badge of honor to get fired. Every football coach in the country gets fired. Every basketball coach in the country gets fired. I don't care who you are, you get fired. People get fired in Hollywood, they get one job, they're a big star, never get hired again, so whatever happened to them, well, nobody uses them anymore. It's a badge of honor. But see, in regular, normal society, if you say you got fired from Joe's Bar and Grill down there, it's like it's shameful. I got fired. What'd you do wrong? Well, you didn't do anything wrong. You just didn't get along. So it's never a good way to leave any company, I don't think. I don't think there's ever a good way to leave. Oh, we left on good terms. Hey, why'd you leave if the terms were so good? Yeah, call them and say, you know what, this job I just took is not very good. Can I come back? Well, no. The door's open for you to come back anytime. Bullshit. Yes, sir. Valentine and I got along okay. I mean, his generation was a little bit ahead of me where he was into that real hardcore wrestling. He wanted to be like his father. And Greg's just not a very pleasant guy. He's always like slow and sleeping and miserable about something. But I was a show business guy, and I called our tag team Rhythm and Blues. I was Rhythm, and he was Snooze. But he was just on a tour with me 3 weeks ago up in upstate New York and up that way for 10 days. And we were back together, and I was seeing him in Howard, Minnesota. End of the month. That's where I'm at, in the mind. I couldn't remember. I'm up there in Minnesota somewhere now. I think so, yeah. Maybe. I really don't know. The thing about entertainment and pro sports is guys cannot get along on the field or not get along in the locker room sometimes, and the next day it's all over. It doesn't matter. You know, you can have things and have problems, But the next day it's all over. Because you've got to see each other every day. Look, if I'm on the road with you for 90 days straight in a row, we're going to have to get along. I mean, it's obvious because we're going to be together. It's just how it is. Yes, sir.
What's your story with Nick Bockwinkel?
Okay, the Nick Bockwinkel story. That's a funny story. Nick came into WWE. For some reason, Vince gave a lot of the old guys jobs. He gave Baron a job. Brought him in and let him manage the Powers of Pain. He gave Nick a job. He gave different people jobs. And Nick was the agent type guy that went around with us and gave out, told us what to do at night and everything. You know, he'd call back to the office and tell on everyone, you know. Then we had to start having drug tests. Yes. They put up on the board, test tonight. And I would always say, a test? I didn't study for it. I didn't do any drugs, it didn't matter. But we would have to go in then and do the urine test. And in the beginning, it was an honor system. There is no honor amongst wrestlers. I don't know why Vince thought there would be. We have a meeting one time. You guys aren't going to believe this, but it's the truth. It's so bizarre. Vince calls us in. We have a big meeting. Right around the lunch hour, and everybody. He said, fellas, we got some problems with the test. I don't know what's going on, but they told me that some of the samples have come back and they were not human samples. Now you gotta see Vince, you gotta see him standing there. You know, he's always groomed perfectly, the tie is perfect. He's very much like Trump. The tie is perfect, the suit is perfect, the pants are absolutely perfect. You know, $4,000 Armani suits he wears every day. Vince is like groomed to the max. I don't know who his valet is, but they do dress him very nice. I've never seen a guy wear the same suit of clothes, or the same shoes, or the same necktie. Anyway. Perfect. Time to go home. So, picture Vince standing there going, and it's not human. He said, fellas, the sample has come back to be. Now, he didn't say it like we would. He said, canine urine. He didn't say dog piss. He said canine urine. It's canine urine. Well, we only had one canine there, and that was Matilda the dog. So Matilda was urinating for other guys. True story. It was canine. But you got to picture him standing there calling canine urine. Fellas, this dog piss. We only got one dog here now. So then Nick was chosen to be the one to go into the shower room with you. You guys know where I'm going with this? True story. I wish Nick was here. I loved him to death. Great guy. Just a perfect gentleman. Just absolutely gorgeous guy. Just fantastic. They gave Nick a nickname. The head picker checker. Because he had to stand there and watch you. And guys would go into the stall and they would carry a Visine bottle in with some canine piss or somebody else's urine and put it under their arm and get it warm and stay in there and say, come on out of there, hurry up, somebody else got to get in there and get the thing warmed up. Then they'd take it and they'd squirt it in the test and they'd take it back and get it to the doctor. Because when they checked it, they had to know that it was warm, because if it came out cold, then obviously there's something going on. I mean, these wrestlers are pretty damn smart. I would never even thought about shit like that. But I'm not into criminal activity. I mean, these guys think about stuff. I would never have dreamed of putting a Visine thing bottle under my arm and get it warm and then put it in. Just don't smoke any marijuana and don't do any drugs. But they did. So Nick would have to watch, and he was reduced to doing that. So I get down to WCW, and Nick is there. Just getting a paycheck off turn. So I go there and say, "Hey, Nick, what's up, man? How you doing?" He says, "Wayne, my boy." That's my first name. Middle name. "Wayne, my boy, I just want to tell you right now, I'm the executive director here. I am no longer the head pecker checker." And I gave him a big hug, and I said, "Well, man, I tell you what, you're really moving up in the world, Nick." But him and I were friends. We had been friends for, you know, a long, long time. And I never got to wrestle Nick. I wish I could have. Then he got to be in charge of the Cauliflower Alley out in Las Vegas. Any of you guys ever gone out for that? Anyway, I had not joined it, but they would send me little newsletters and things trying to get me to join. And finally, one day it came, and I don't know, I was just in one of those booths, but they had a character. Someone had drawn a cartoon character. Nick, feet were together like this, a little bitty skinny legs. His body, and it looked just like him in his face, the cartoon character, and the hair was perfect and everything. And it said, "From the desk of Nicholas Bockwinkel." Now, you got to understand, Nick was the kind of guy, and Bobby Heenan would always say this, "Don't ask Nick what time it is, because Nick will tell you how to build a watch." But just seeing that, I said, "I'm joining this damn thing for life," and I did. And I sent him a letter, and I said, "Nick, it's only because of that character of you and that thing that I did this." But it was funny, and I said, "Yeah, I've talked to Nick for quite a while." So I called him up, got his number. We were driving on in the van. They call him up. Nick answers and gets on the phone with me. It was from one of the good days where Nick. Toward the end, Nick had gotten to where he couldn't find the bathroom by himself. Someone had to be with him. He got that bad. One minute, he would be fine. And the next minute, he'd look at you like he didn't know you. But this was a good day. He was on the phone with me, and he was talking about, "So, Nick, how are you getting along? Everything good?" And he started telling me a story. He said, "You know, when this was like building the watch. You know, I was talking to someone the other day, and I told him I'm like a bicycle tire. You know how you take the bicycle, you get a flat on the bicycle. He tells me about fixing a flat on the bicycle. And you put a patch here, a patch there, and a patch here. And he said, now I've got two walking canes, and you know what's strong?" And he had me hooked really good. I mean, he's reeling me in. I said, "You know, Nick, how's that?" He said, "I've got all these patches on me, and I've got two walking canes right now from a fake farming business." And I said, "That's right, Nick, you're right." And it's true. We got all these patches on us and all these things. My hips bother me now. My neck hurts. I've been four or five broken noses, perforated ear canal. My teeth are cracked. I almost lost my finger 7 or 8 years ago in a stupid stunt. I've had a cracked ankle. I never went to the head of fixed. But it was all from something that's not real. What? That's my Nick story. Nick was a great guy. And I knew you guys would know a little bit because Nick wrestled around this area a lot. And it's important that you know that he was really, really a fine guy. A great man. I never met Bergogna. I never met the work for Dick the Bruiser. But most of the guys out of Minneapolis I knew and talked to and was with them over the years. We all traveled and we'd see each other in different places. That's what's good, so good about what we did. Woo! 16 times world champion. Woo! That means you lost at least 16 matches. They call Ric Flair the greatest wrestler of all time. He lost 16 matches. He brags about it. "I lost one match in the open war, and they said I was something terrible. Oh, you honky-tonk, that's horrible. Oh, he lost one time." I think the last show I did with you guys, I was out there doing that. You made a joke about it. Man, I've got to stop doing this. I almost had a heart attack when I did it. I mean, damn old Flair, I mean, he's been they've been working on him. He's sitting in, he said something the other day, he's still drinking. He said, yes, the doctors told me that all the drinking, he said it did, it's not the problem that I'm having. You've been drunk for 50 years and that's not a problem? Woo! So, I think Rick just needs to go away, let his daughter be his daughter, let her grow up and be somebody and get away and everything. Leave her alone, but he can't do it. He cannot do it. He will not leave that spotlight. I never pushed my children to do anything. I never pushed my daughter to be a veterinarian. I never pushed my son to do anything. He played golf and scholarship in college, which was in Arizona and Phoenix, a very, very hard thing to do where the best golfers in the world try to come to Phoenix and play and be in college. And he did that and did it on his own. He trained himself. He learned how to do it himself. He never had a lesson. And my daughter wanted to be work with animals since she was like 5 years old. And she just continued on. And she continued on. Went in that direction in college. And she got her degree in microbiology. Of all things that I don't even know anything about. And the best thing about what she did was I could not, as a parent, interfere. Because I didn't know anything about it. If she wanted to get into wrestling or into sports or my son wanted to get into it, I didn't know anything about golf. So I couldn't interfere with that either. I mean, it's like, Dad, how was practice? Oh, it's good, but okay. It's very important for you parents out there, especially you young, upcoming parents. Let the kids do what the kids want to do, okay? I live mine. I don't want my kids to live the life I live. I never pushed my son to be in the wrestling business because it takes a special, unique individual to do some things in life. I've always said if he was here today, I'd say he did not have the grit in his crawl. He didn't have it in here. You have to have a strong desire, you have to be dedicated, and you have to be willing to work hard at any job if you're going to succeed. At any job, I don't care what it is. But if you don't have that grit in your craw, and you don't have that strong desire, and it's not in your heart, you'll get eaten alive out here in pro sports and the entertainment business. I mean, that's a chew 'em up, spit 'em out factory. They don't care. I was fortunate enough that I had those things and a good work ethic. And I didn't mind working hard. And I did. And I worked my way to the top of the WWE. It was definitely was not given to me. I can promise you that. I was not even being considered for the Intercontinental Championship. That was going to someone else. They happened to not show up that night. I just happened to walk by when there was a conversation going on about it. And they said, what about this guy? And that's how it happened. I would have just plugged along there as a mid-card or upper card guy, lower card guy, back and forth, bounced around for 4, 5, 10 years or whatever, and then probably quit. And then went somewhere else because there was places to go. I was able to travel around the world and get paid for it. I've probably been in 30, 35 countries. It's not a glamorous, glorious life by any means. Sleeping on the floor in pretty much every airport in the United States. I loved it when they changed the carpet up at Midway. And Detroit, finally. It was one of those things where it was hard, but the end result was you're working toward a goal somewhere. And it's like I said, I wanted a better life for my wife and children, and I wanted a little bit better quality of life for myself. And I sacrificed by doing that, by sleeping in airports, by doing all these things for all these years. And I still do it. I mean, if something would have happened last night and The flight would have been canceled out of Chicago coming down here. It was the last flight of the night coming down here. I got here 10 o'clock last night. If it had been canceled, I would have been sleeping on the floor of Chicago last night. I slept there before. I mean, nothing new. I carried an alarm clock and everything. I mean, just, it's in my bag. I carried an alarm clock. But to go out and do this stuff and do it the way I did it, I enjoyed every minute of it. I'm telling you. I enjoyed the characters I was around. It would be the Rick Valentine that was sleeping all the time, or Jim Ross. My God, Jim Ross. My God. See, now I'm going to get blamed for that. Someone's going to say, Honey, don't man was talking bad about Jim Ross. No, I was not. That was this guy over here. Well, that's why I make fun of him. He said, I hear you make fun of me on your economy, Jim. I said, no, I don't, Jim. I just tell the truth. By God! He's the greatest athlete in the WWE. Stone Cold! Stone Cold! Stone Cold! Yeah. How many times did Jim Ross say Stone Cold in like 45 seconds? Stone Cold! Stone Cold! Shut up, Ross. We know his name. It was over and over and over. I call him the spin doctor because he can put the best spin on anything. Now he's not working with WWE. You should hear him now. You should read some of the stuff he's writing. Oh, he's a spin doctor for the other company now. Oh, gosh. Anybody have a question about my career or anything else? I don't care. Just ask me anything. Well,
I'm the best there is, the best there was, and technical technician.
Who's that? Brett is not the greatest of any. Brett's Brett. I mean, bullshit, Brett.
The excellent execution.
I get this because I went to Calgary. I told you I met my wife there. I went up to Calgary. I was living on a beach in Pensacola, Florida. I was resting 4 days 1 week, 5 days the next week. Our longest trip was 300 miles on a Monday. Then we had 100 miles to Mobile, and then we were in Pensacola. We were off on Wednesday, stayed at the beach all day, drank beer, and did all the things that you do on the beach. And then, but anyway, I went up to Calgary, and I'm on the beach in Pensacola. I have a pair of cowboy boots. I have my university jacket, letter jacket, the wool jacket, you know, with the sleeves and everything. I had blue jeans. And I didn't have any winter clothes. I've been living down south my whole life. I've not even been in cold weather. I've never crossed the Mason-Dixon line. You know, I mean, the furthest I'd ever been north was like Louisville, Kentucky or something. That's freezing ass cold over there. But anyway, I get up here to Calgary, 35 below zero. It's not cold here. It's cold there. That's cold. They said, make sure that you... I said, what's those... Why would people have their extension cord plugged into their car? They said, oh, it's a motor blocker. You have to have that. I said, what is a motor blocker? Oh, if you don't put that in your car, your motor will crack here just from the cold weather. What? I wasn't so worried about that. I said, does anybody steal the cords? Oh, no. I mean, everybody's got to have one. Nobody steals them. I go off to Regina on the first trip after I have my motor block heater put in. I come back. My cord's gone. I told the guy, I said, you said nobody steals the cords. He said, did you wrap around and drive your car and the tire up on it? I said, no. You told me nobody. He said, well, that's the only way to keep people from taking them. But you told me they won't steal cords. Anyway. Then I get way back down south to Pensacola about 6 months later, a year later, I have to take my car to the Cadillac shop. Oh, yeah, I'm driving a Cadillac, Becky. Yeah, I was kicked back, living large. Take it down to the shop in Pensacola, and the guy said, what's this cord hanging out in front of the car? I said, that's a motor block here. He said, a what? Now, he's a mechanic for Cadillac in Pensacola. He never heard of it. He said, what does it do? And I explained it to him, what the cord was, and he had to get up and under and look and said, I got to see this. So he wanted to see where it got plugged in and everything on the side of the block. And then I said, that's not half of it. He said, make sure you put gas line antifreeze in the gas tank. Why? Because the gas will freeze. What? Yes. Oh, you better get some of that stuff for your locks on the car because you can't get the key in the lock either. They freeze. What? I sound like that commercial on TV. What? I sound like Stone Cold. This is the God's honest truth. This is the shit that I've gone through. That ain't even the half of it. So now I'm going to pull up to Stu Hart's house, right? I drove 3-4 days, you know, it was like 800 miles, 900, 1,000 miles, 3,500 fucking miles up there. I get up there and I pull up to Stu's house, ring the doorbell, ring it. Finally, he comes to the door. Now, he doesn't ask me to come in. He comes out on the porch. And I can't even talk because I'm so cold. I can't even feel my feet. I've got cowboy boots on and blue jeans. It's minus 35.
And that's tough. I've heard a lot about you. I think you're going to do very well up here.
You laughing, guys, but that's how he did it, even slower. His sons would call kids in England and places like that, or they would have their kids call Stu's house to talk to Stu about getting a booking. And Stu knew they was on long distance, and Stu would keep them guys on the phone like 3 hours.
I think I can probably.
The guys would get like $300-$400 phone bill for Stu Hart. So then they tell me, Stu's got a beautiful young daughter. She's not dating anyone, you know. Maybe you could move in. So I go over and I see her, beautiful young lady. She married David Bushman. Her name's Diane. Nice girl. So I saw her the whole thing. I go over and I say hello. I said, hi, I'm Monkey Jump Man.
My father speaks very highly of you.
Yes, the girls talk. Everyone in the Hart family sounds like Stu. Has anybody watched that Diva show on TV and had Jim Neihardt, Ellie Neihardt? So I call up to the house when Owen dies. I call up to Stu's house because I want to find out where to send flowers to the funeral. The girl answers the phone.
Hello.
I said, yeah, this is Honky Tonk Man.
This is Ellie, Jim's wife. Have you seen that husband of mine? He's running around with some whores down in Florida. And if you see the bastard, he's dead and don't come back.
I said, Ellie, I want to find out where to send flowers for Owen's
dad. You know, it's a terrible thing, but if you see that goddamn husband of mine, you tell him don't come back.
Jim had left her and was down in Florida running around on her, I guess. And I'm not a marriage counselor. I just want to find out where to send the flowers. This took me 30 minutes. I never found out where to send the flowers. I had to call my friend up there, an English guy, John Foley, a great old-time shooter that trained all the Hart kids. I had to call John's house and get his wife to tell me where to send the flowers because Ellie was too busy telling me all the bad things about Jim and what Jim was doing. So if you guys saw her on that Diva show, did she not sound like that?
Yeah.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yes. And Natty Neihardt,
tell you, when Nettie, if she really has to concentrate not to do it, and Jim would always say, "Hey, he's yeah." You know, we're pulling his chin, right, when he's talking. Jim and I. Nettie will do the same thing. She'll start to do that. Yes, yes. Unbelievable. This, and I loved it so much. I loved the aggravation of 20 heart kids. I don't even know how many there was. There's like 10 of them or more. I loved the aggravation so much, and when I left, I got mad and I quit. I stayed down back to Pensacola for like 3 months. I went back to Calgary and stayed another 2 years. I bought a house up there. Jesus Christ, what was I thinking? Then WWE's taking all these guys. They had taken Brett and Jim, Dynamite and Davey. They had taken them from Calgary. I'd heard about all these great things WWE was doing. I was like, man, will I ever get out of here? Will I ever get out of this place? You know, this is like Animal House with real people. And we're coming back from Regina, Saskatchewan, lovely place, just the name alone. Regina, Saskatchewan. It's like May 15th, May 20th or something, late in May. You can see the lights of Calgary. It's a 500-mile trip, 600 miles. It's about 4 or 5 in the morning. We're getting back. Because you had to drive all night to get back. You can see the lights of Calgary, and it started to snow. And snow. And snow. And in about half hour up there, it snows like you can't even drive a car anymore. Here we are stranded, 30 miles from town, on about the 20th of May, in a snowstorm, and the snowplow didn't come along until about noon that day. Yeah. I said, this is it. I don't give a shit if I have to give the house away. I am leaving this place. I am leaving. I stayed about another 2 weeks, and they had a show come to Calgary, and Hogan was on that show, and Stu booked me on that show, got me on it, because he wanted to put one of his feature matches on the show, and I was a feature match, and he talked Vince into letting two of his guys be on the show, and I was one of them. And I was there and in the locker room, and I saw all these guys that I had known over the 15 years prior to me being in WWE. I'd seen these guys everywhere. I'd been with them. I knew them. Hogan lived in my apartment in Pensacola 10 years before that. Slept on the floor. I put my mattress down. His car was broke down. I let him use my car. Beefcake was with him. That's who Beefcake was. Eddie Leslie, the Boulder brother. So I see Hogan first time in about 10 years. And he saw me and saw what I was doing. And I told this story in my speech at the Hall of Fame. And he thought I would fit in with WWE. And I said, well, if you think so, I'd really like to get out of here. He said, I'll call this guy. This guy loves me. He said, he talks to me 10 times a day. And he said, if you want to come on board, I'll give him a call. I said, man, I don't know how to thank him. He did. Phone rang next morning, 7 o'clock. And it's like, man, 3 days later, I flew down there. He interviewed me for about 20 minutes, saw some tape on me, gave me the job. 3 months later, I was in WWE. That's how it went. And I left with Stu's blessing and saw Stu a couple times after that, not too often. And then he ended up passing away. And I've had this relationship with the Hart family. It's like a fraternity of wearing this ring with other guys now that have this ring. There's a fraternity of us that will always be there. And there's a fraternity of us guys that were in Calgary. Not the guys that just went to Calgary and stayed for a month. Or went there and stayed 2 months. There's a lot of guys went through there. It's the guys that went there and stayed for a period of time. Then came back again and came back again. That's where you build that bond. And every one of those Hart kids, I have a bond with them. And you know, they're all now passing away. Different things have happened. Smith Hart just passed away. He had cancer. Brett had a colon stair. Owen passed away from a terrible accident. Of course, Jim Nyhart. Jim's gone now. One of the other Hart boys, Dean, he, I don't know what happened to Dean. They found him out in the front yard in the snowstorm, you know, whatever. That's many, many years ago. He had gotten bad on methamphetamines and all this nonsense and just ended up going out in the front yard, laying down in the snowstorm. I guess they hadn't found the track, so we wouldn't know he was out there. It's a snow covered. So after that, with WWE, I went there and I started plugging along to make this thing happen. And it finally did. And I always knew that if I ever got a chance to make any money, that I would sock that stuff away like a squirrel for the winter. Because in our business, there was no guarantees, no promises. We did not have what these new kids have now. They all have a contract. Whether they work or not, they get paid. If I didn't work in lacrosse on Saturday night, I didn't get paid. If I didn't make it to Minneapolis on Sunday, I didn't get paid. If we didn't work, we didn't get paid. I didn't have any insurance. I had injuries, but I kept working. Because if I did not work, I did not get paid. And if I did not work, there was somebody in the locker room ready to take my spot. We had no protection. We had no union. We had nothing. It was up to you to do everything. And that's what I did. I had learned very early from a promoter named Nick Goulas in Nashville. When he paid me once, it was like 7 days worth of work. I got $300. And I said, Nick, I can't live on this. He said, he always cursed everything. Everything was goddamn. Goddamn, boy. He said, goddamn, boy. It ain't what you make. Goddamn, it's what you save. I said, Nick, I can't even save any money. Damn it, boy, I just told you it's not what you make, it's what you save. I live by that today. It's really not what you make, it is what you save. I mean, we all think we're worth more than what we are. I mean, it doesn't matter. My son, he got no college education. When the golf was over, he quit school. He's driving for Amazon. Hell, he thinks he's worth $25 an hour. What? Oh, I know, one of you Democrats, $15 an hour. If McDonald's start paying $15 an hour, you ain't going to get a Big Mac for $2 anymore. Price is going to go up. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I hate them all. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Jake's name. What's up with that?
Jake is high. Jake's name. Jake's really mad at me. He said, he tried to buy my name. Well, if Vince trademarks your name, Vince is a genius. If I trademark your name, I'm an asshole. I didn't trademark Jake's name because it wouldn't work $275 to do it. I didn't think he'd live long enough for me to make any money off of it. I don't think he'll ever die. Is he sober? Is he straight? Is he into those things? I would have to not take my eyes off of him for like 3 days straight in a row to find out. I mean, I wouldn't even be able to sleep or anything. I would have to watch him the whole time. I would have to be like Nick Bockwinkel when he went to the bathroom. That's the only way I believe Jake Roberts is on the straight and narrow. Because he's conned his way through his whole life. He's lied about a lot of things. He's lied about his family. He's lied about he had cancer. He had pneumonia. He's had all these things. He's had these GoFundMes and people send him money. It's worse than a preacher on Sunday morning. It's worse than a televangelist on TV. Diamond Dallas Page. All I got to do is cross my hands and take a deep breath. And yoga's going to heal me. Yoga got Jake Roberts off a crack pipe. Bullshit. Yoga didn't have anything to do with that crack pipe.
think very highly of Jake, but Jake doesn't think very highly of me. I guess we're in a stalemate. I don't know why he's so upset about that. So what? All I was trying to do is help him. He wouldn't have made any more money. He could have bought any more crap. Jake says I hit him with a guitar and put him in rehab. Okay? If I hit Jake Roberts with a guitar and I hurt him so bad, he would have went to the hospital, not to rehab. Jake Roberts was in rehab twice before I hit him with a guitar. The guitar was the third, after that was the third time he went into rehab. And then he went into rehab again and again and again. The guitar had nothing to do with Jake Roberts' rehab. Obviously going to rehab don't help him either. It was just another day at the office. No, it was not like, I mean, I didn't have any ill will toward Jake at all. I mean, he was just another guy that we were going to do something with. You know, I mean, it was not a, you know, go out and listen, when you hit Jake Roberts, you try to kill that son of a bitch. You know, Vince never told me that. It's like steroids. Vince never told anybody to take steroids. I had to go up to New York and testify in front of the federal grand jury. And I told them on the phone twice everything that I was going to tell the grand jury. I never heard Vince tell anyone to take steroids. I never saw Vince take steroids. He never told me to take them. He never mailed them to me. I never called her and had them mail to me. I took them because I wanted to. I took them when I was in college. I took them before I got to WWE. But they drug me up to the grand jury, and that's exactly what I told those people, and they still put him on trial. That was absolute nonsense. They called me to come testify. I said, look, I'm moving, man. I can't do it. They said, we're going to spend you. I said, well, do whatever you want to, but good luck, because I'm going across the country. And they said, well, we'll have a subpoena waiting on you in Phoenix. I didn't go to Phoenix. I turned that son of a bitch north. I went to Calgary. I went to Farmington. I went to Canada. They couldn't do anything. But you know what those assholes did? They called my mother-in-law's house looking for me. Won't know if I was there. As if I was going to leave a foreign country or they're going to subpoena me in Canada and I'm going to come back. That's like subpoenaing those Russians over there. Oh, yeah, they got all the convictions on them Russians. Mueller got 16 convictions. Yeah, 16 Russians. Good luck getting them back over here, brother. You didn't convict nothing. Come on. Good luck. What would you do? Oh, okay, I'll come back. I did. I came back when it was over. Yes, sir. The first match in WWE was, I was at a television taping over in Brampton, Ontario, just outside of Toronto. There was probably 3,500 people in there or less. It was not a big TV taping like they have now, but it was no different than anything else. I just wanted to go out and you know, they gave me a decent guy to go out with and do what I did and, you know, showcase my talents. I'd been hired, so I wasn't auditioning for a job at that point. So if you're not really auditioning, then it's a lot easier when you got the job and you're going in and you're going in. You know, if you're going to go in, like my sheriff's department guy here, and you know all the guys there, and you're going in and you're getting a new job at another facility, but you know half the guys there, you're not auditioning. Well, you're going in on the first day, and hey, the ring is no different. And, well, I had been in front of large audiences before. I worked in Puerto Rico in front of 20,000 people at the Roberto Clemente Stadium in San Juan. We did that every month. I worked in all over Puerto Rico. We had good crowds. I worked in Trinidad in front of 50,000 people in Trinidad and Barbados in front of 20,000. I had been 6 weeks in Japan in front of big crowds. I worked in Memphis on sold-out shows
Memphis, Louisville, Evansville, you know, the Mid-South Coliseum was 14,000 people. We did that every Monday night, and I did that for years. Pardon? What? No, never. No, not after I had, not after Luke Evans beat the shit out of me. I'm even going. I must have been nervous that night because that's why he beat me up. And then the real high point of my career was getting the Intercontinental Championship, because then I had a chance. Thank you, thank everybody else. Then I had a chance to really, really show them what I could do, because I knew if I ever got the chance, I knew I could sell tickets, because I had sold tickets to people before. I was selling out in Calgary. I sold out in Vancouver when I was working over there. I sold out all across different places, everywhere I've gone. I sold out in Puerto Rico. I sold out in Memphis with the Tupelo concession stand match. Yes, the hardcore match that created hardcore. So I knew, and I sold out in Mobile and Pensacola against Austin Idol and different guys down there. And I knew what I could do. And I knew what I needed to do to really make, to be a good bad guy. I had the tools. I knew what to do. And I knew what to say and how to say it to touch those nerves with people to make them want to kill my ass. And if they want to kill me, or if they think they can beat me up, then they know that Jimmy Snuka can beat me. They know that, ooh, he, Macho Man, can beat me up. But then every time I go on TV, ah, look here, Mean Gene. I still have it. The greatest Intercontinental Champion of all time. No one can beat me. I'm the greatest of all time. And every kid out there that was 8 years old said, oh, I could kill him myself. I would do this interview. Yeah, when I get to La Crosse next Saturday night, I'm coming to town early. I'm going to walk the streets of La Crosse. Walk the streets of where Wynonna, Minnesota. I'm looking for a fight. You know what, Mean Gene? There ain't nobody over in Minnesota going to fight. There ain't nobody in Wisconsin. Cheese there, they ain't going to fight. But I'm going to walk the streets looking for a fight. Well, you might get one at La Crosse with Macho Man Savage Saturday night. Nah, Macho Man, he ain't going to do nothing to me. I'm the greatest of all time. Then people would line up around the building to see me get my ass kicked. Yes, I was very good at that. I was very good at controlling people's emotions to get them to come to see me get beat. They didn't care who beat me. And here's why. You need another beer. A couple more, you'll be ready. But anyway, I knew these things to say, and I knew how to do this, and I knew how to make it work. And all the good bad guys were all very good at what they did. Piper was good at what he did, being a good bad guy. When Sergeant Slaughter turned to be a bad guy, to be the bad Marine guy, he was very good at it. When Hogan turned bad in NWO, he was very good at it. He did a lot of stuff. He did the same stuff that I did. And we were uniquely different. But the people turned out to see me lose. They didn't care if it was Lanny Poffo or S.D. Jones. Or they didn't care. You know, they turned out by the thousands in Milwaukee, in Denver, in Minneapolis, in San Francisco, because Jake Roberts was in rehab. And they would bring a substitute in. And for those shows, they brought in the Crusher. They sold out, turned people away, because they knew the Crusher was going to finally kick my ass. And this is it. And he couldn't move in. Still got it, Mean Gene, the greatest of all time. Jay Roberts is in rehab. Philadelphia sold out. Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Miami, all the towns on the East Coast. We had 1 week to promote a substitute for Madison Square Garden. They brought in Bruno. One interview on TV, Bruno. turned people away at Madison Square Garden, Boston, Chicago, Philadelphia, Miami, because they knew this is it. Bruno is going to win. He's going to finally beat this guy. Didn't happen. Yeah, didn't happen. If they would do that nowadays, the business could turn around that fast. Just that fast. But they're so afraid. Now that they're corporate, they're so afraid that a stockholder or the shareholders or the sponsors are going to say, we don't like that honky-tonk man. My children hate him. For some reason, Vince is letting the shareholders and the stockholders and all these people determine how he's running his business. I guess last week they decided to go a little bit further down. Somebody gave the finger and somebody said a bad word on TV. They're going to push it a little bit further over the edge now because they need it. They need something different. The old clean cut, we all get along, and there's not a good guy. I remember him telling me once, there's not any such thing as good guys and bad guys anymore. We can't do that anymore. Well, if you don't have the bad guy that the Terminator is trying to go terminate, then there's no reason to have a Terminator. You see what I'm saying? If you go and see the Western, and if the Western movie, the one guy dressed in black is a gunslinger that comes to town and causing all kind of trouble, and you got the nice young sheriff or something, you know, if you don't have the good versus evil, you don't have a movie. You know, you got to have that conflict there. And until they get that back, I don't think they'll be able to change the business. I just don't think they can change it with three-way dance matches. Oh, all three guys are good guys, or all three guys are bad guys. And who are we going to cheer for? We need somebody to go, yay, and we need somebody to go, boo. Simple. You got to have it. If they advised me or asked me one question, that's what I'd say. Bring back the bad guys, bring back the good guys. Have a clean-cut good guy. Have a good, bad guy that can go out and make people mad. If people are mad, they'll buy tickets. If they buy tickets, the shareholders are going to be happy anyway. If you're selling on TV and the prices are up, the stocks are up, the people are going to be happy. It's just that simple. Whether you like Trump or not, the stock market hit. They did a hat trick today. All three were up. Yes. And that Kamala Harris. Well, if you got stocks, I guess you're happy. Well, everybody's got a 401k. He's got stocks. For Christ's sakes, what's wrong with that idiot? They're all goofy. Okay. To do what? Not really. It was never a personal thing. It was never personal at all about anyone. Because we're all one. We're all on the same team. We're all in the same locker room. We all sweat the same sweat. We all travel the same travel. We all smell the same after 30 days on the road. With me, it was all about the position. If you tell me when you hire me, we shake hands and we got a handshake deal on, you're going to do this for me and I'm going to do this for you, and everything goes along and everybody's living up to the agreement, and one day you go along and say, you know what? I got to put you back on that disc digging, man. I know the weed eater is a lot easier, but and I told you you'd never be back in the ditch, but we got this other guy. He wants the weed eater. You need to go back. And that's when you say, no. So I thought Benjamin needed on me on a deal. And unless he ever tells me he didn't, then him and I will never really close that chapter. And it was never personal. And people think it was between me and Macho Man, but it was not, it never was. It's all about national television. And I still think today there are certain people that Vince does not ever, they never lose. Undertaker, once in 25 years.
Well, that's why he's the Undertaker, because you guys know he always wins.
Hogan never lost. Shawn Michaels never lost. Bret never lost. Stone Cold never lost. There's certain people that never lost. But then there's other people that they want you to lose every night. Well, if you lose every night, you lose value. You lose value in the eyes of the fans. You're a loser. You're a loser. You know, it's like Ironheart Sharp. Great worker out there and everything. But, I mean, everybody knew Ironheart Sharp was going to lose. I mean, everybody out there knew Lanny Poffo was going to lose. So he never had a big following. Was there guys that refused to lose to me? And it was just because personally they did not want to lose to me? Yeah. A couple of guys. Brett never wanted to lose to anybody, so I can't blame Brett for that. I mean, he wasn't going to lose, period. He's the best there ever was. Tito Santana never liked to lose, especially to me. Ricky Steamboat said he didn't mind losing the Intercontinental belt, he just didn't want to lose it to me. I never knew we had a problem. Still don't. But if that's a problem, that's his problem, not mine. I had the belt. He had it 6 weeks. I had it for about 16 months. Yes, sir. Well, and nowadays they don't have a say in anything, there's kids. We had some part of creative control that we didn't want to do. We didn't pack our bag and leave. You know, it's very simple. But the promoter always has to, I mean, it's his show. They know where they want to go with certain people. You know what I'm saying? You know when you buy a car pretty much how long you want to keep it. And you know if things start to happen to it, well, this is like a piece of talent, like a Jake Roberts. If he's breaking down all the time and he's going into rehab, you know, we got to get rid of this guy. He's got to be phased out. Or this old car's been got too old. He needs to be moved on now. And I'm going to keep this car 5 years and we're going to move on. So it's all a planned out thing. It's not a lot of stuff that just happens. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. In the back.
What was it like working with Jimmy Hart?
Jimmy Hart. Very good. I'm glad you asked that. You must know the ending to the show. I told you I lost one match. And it was to the bomb, 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 Ultimate Warrior. Yes, I know. Everybody went, oh, gosh, man, I just hope somebody beats Honky Tonk Man. I hope somebody beats anybody. I don't care who beats it. Bomb, 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 bomb. 30 seconds later, the new Intercontinental Champion, Ultimate Warrior, went, oh, no, not him. So, see, you fans can't be happy, can you? You just can't be happy. So I worked with Jimmy Hart. Jimmy Hart's the most positive guy in the world. Jimmy, it's pouring down rain. Oh, baby, it's lovely. Jimmy, it's ice cold. It's freezing out. Oh, it's lovely, baby. Jimmy, this guy's killing me. Oh, it's lovely, baby. So I'm with the Ultimate Warrior. He's picking me up by my throat. He's squeezing me so hard that I can't even breathe. And he's pressing me over his head. And he's holding me by my privates. And he's holding me really, really tight by my privates. And my throat. I can't scream because I can't breathe. And I'm getting a vasectomy every night with no anesthesia. So after about the third or fourth night, I go to him and I say, Warrior, look, here's how you're going to have to do. You're killing me. I can't take this anymore. And I showed him how he needs to pick me up without choking me to death or castrating me. So we did that. But in the meantime, I would tell Jimmy Hart, Jimmy, this guy's killing me. Oh, he's looking at me. Everything's ready. Everything's ready. So I go to the Warrior one night. I pick this up, pick the building. The longest walkway of the whole thing.
And I said, "A warrior, tonight, instead of you picking me up, I want you to pick Jimmy Hart up." You guys know where I'm going with this? I said, "Now you got to remember, warrior, Jimmy's not a wrestler. Vince has big plans for you. There's 20,000 people out there tonight. He's going to be squirming and yelling and screaming and kicking. I said, if you drop him, it's going to look real bad for you. You cannot drop him. Remember how you would squeeze me?" I said, "You've got to get him twice as hard." I said, "Here's what you do now. When he comes in and hits you with a megaphone, you drop me and you go for him. And when you get him, I want you to walk back like molasses in winter. You want everyone to see it. Slow." So I go to Jimmy Hart. I said, "Jimmy, tonight, instead of the thing where you come in and hit you, you hit him. I said, you run back to the curtain, but don't run all the way through the curtain. Let Jim catch you right there at the curtain. And he's going to pick you up like he picks me up and walk back with you." "Oh, okay, yeah. All right, baby." Jimmy runs, warrior gets him. I'm laying in the ring sideways, just watching. And I know he's got him. Because I can see these veins in the warrior's arms. He's so purple. Oh, Jimmy squirts.
He's trying to get away.
He can't. Throws him in the ring. Oh, Jimmy's hair's all messed up. Collar turned sideways. Sunglasses on sideways. Throws him in the ring. I roll out and I'm waiting. He rolls out. I grab him. And say, "Oh, Jesus Christ. Man, you're right. Holy shit. He damn near killed me. He pulled my nuts out." I said, "Everything's lovely, baby." Walk.